Humility in Worship from Selected Psalms. This is an exposition of Psalm 90. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, March the 7th, 2018.
Warren Wiersbe gave a definition of worship, which I really like. It's really, I think, almost my favorite definition of worship. Worship is the response of all that I am to all that God is, says, and does. So worship is the response of my total being, everything that I am, my will, my emotions, my intellect, everything about me responding to all that God is, His person, His character, and His activity. If that's the case, then true worship, biblical worship, demands two things. One, a clear vision of God. If I'm going to worship God, I need to see who He is. I need to have an understanding of His character. I need to understand what He's like and what He requires. I need a clear vision of God. But second, I also need an honest evaluation of who I am. So if I'm going to engage in true, authentic, biblical worship, I need to see God for who He is, and I need to see me for who I am. I need to understand what God is about, His character and so forth, but I also need to understand who and what I really am. I must understand that God is holy, that He is distinct, that He is different, that He is transcendent, that He is above and beyond, that He is the creator and sustainer of all life, that He is the sovereign ruler of everything that it is, everything that is. And I need to understand that I am a sinner. I am depraved in both heart and mind. I'm a creature. And as such, I am dependent upon Him for everything. Even the breath that I take, the fact that I'm existing, I owe to Him. And if not for His continual mercy and grace, I wouldn't even exist. So this is where worship begins. I understand who God is, and I understand who and what I am. And the thing is, that's humiliating. So it's not high on the list of most of us. Very few Americans have on their list of to-do, be humiliated today. And yet, humility is absolutely essential to worship. I can't worship biblically, I can't worship in truth without humility. Unless I'm humbled, unless I really see who and what I am in light of who God is, I cannot worship. If you listen to the experts today, you might get the impression that the purpose of worship is to build self-esteem in the congregation. The whole reason for our gathering is that so people can feel better about themselves. And so worship is geared toward that. And decisions are made about worship along those lines. Well, how is this going to help people feel better? How are they going to have a better experience? And all those kind of issues surrounding it. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying, because I'm not suggesting that, well, I don't want to focus on making people feel better, so biblical worship must be make sure we beat them up. Make sure we beat them down. Make sure that they leave feeling miserable. I don't think that the self-loathing of the Puritans was necessarily a healthy thing. But there's a balance. Too often we're like spoiled children. Spoiled children who think, if I don't get everything I want, when I want it, and the way I want it, some great evil's been done to me. And unfortunately, that seems to be an attitude of an awful lot of folks when it comes to the church. If within the church, if within the worship of the church, if within the experience of life in the church, I don't get what I want, the way I want it, when I want it, is something wrong has been done. Well, that's not a biblical way of understanding. That's the fruit of self-worship. Truth is, we were made to bring glory and honor to God, and the only way we can be truly happy is to do the thing we were created to do. true joy and happiness is going to come when we function the way God created us to function. The road to joyful worship often takes some unexpected turns, and we'll see that tonight as we consider Psalm 90. Psalm 90, again, we'll look at the entire psalm. It's just 17 verses. This is the first psalm in book 4 of the Psalms, which is Psalm 90 through Psalm 106. It is attributed to Moses. And as such, it is the only psalm attributed to him. J.M. Boyce thinks that the context of Psalm 90 may be Numbers 20. In Numbers chapter 20, we read about the death of Miriam, Moses' sister. That's also the chapter where Moses strikes the rock and it causes him to miss the promised land. It's also the death of his brother Aaron. So it was not a good time. It was a time of great heartache and tragedy in the life of Moses. And yet, when you read through the psalm, it doesn't read bitter. It doesn't read as a complaint. It's somber, but there seems to be an awareness of the greatness and the glory of God. Think about what must have been running through Moses' mind and heart. His brother and sister have died. He's been informed, you will not enter the promised land. What must have been going through his mind and heart? I mean, when you lose everything, you lose that which is most dear to you, you lose family, and you lose the goal of your life to enter the land of promise. All that's taken away from you. And then you come read Psalm 90 in that context. It really reads different. Because in spite of all of that heartache and all of that pain, there is an element of the greatness and the glory of God throughout. So as we work our way through, we're going to discover that the worshiping heart understands man's mortality in contrast to the greatness and the glory of God. He said two things were necessary for worship: clear vision of God and an honest evaluation of who I am. The worshiping heart sees the frailty and the mortality of man in contrast to the greatness and glory of God. Four characteristics of a worshiping heart. First, in verses 1 and 2. The worshiping heart stands in awe of the glory and the grandeur of God. Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Derek Kinder suggests that only Isaiah 40 compares with Psalm 90 and its contrast of God's grandeur and man's frailty. In the psalm, there's a reflection on human mortality and the brevity of life. At the same time, there's a quiet confidence in God and his steadfast hope of righteousness. Moses was in a unique position to understand the greatness and glory of God because Moses knew God intimately and he spoke with God face to face. So he has a unique perspective. Look at the opening verses. Lord, that's title. That's not the name Yahweh. That's the title. Sovereign one. Boss. Ruler. You are our dwelling place. That speaks of a fixed and settled home. It's sometimes translated in other places as refuge, place of safety. Now think about that. For 40 years, Israel's been wandering around the wilderness. Moses knew something about life being transient. He knew something about there being uncertainty. They're just wandering around. They're moving about the desert. But he speaks of God as this fixed, settled, secure place. And he makes that statement at the end of verse 2. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So the way I would look at that phrase, from everlasting to everlasting, all right, from everlasting, go as far as you want backwards. Go to eternity past. and to everlasting, go to eternity future. And whether you go all the way back or you go all the way ahead or at any point along the way, God is God. He was God way back there. He will be God way up there. And He is God right now. So Moses, when everything is lost, he's lost family, he's lost brother, sister, he's lost the chance, the opportunity, the glory of entering the land of promise. Everything's taken away from him. And his acknowledgement is, you're God. You are the eternal one. You are the ruler. You are the sovereign of all things. The worshiping heart understands that and acknowledges the greatness, the grandeur, and the glory of God. This is where worship begins. This is the starting point for worship. We begin with the understanding that God alone is God. That He's in a category all His own. Now contrast that with the second thing beginning in verse 3. The worshiping heart humbly acknowledges the transient frailty of man. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You are our dwelling place. You are that fixed, settled place. In contrast to that, you return man to dust. And say, return, O children of man. For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They're like a dream. Like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. And in the evening it fades and withers. The focus of the psalmist is on the weakness of man and the brevity of his life. It may well be that Moses has in mind Genesis 3:19. God speaking to man and the curse says, you are dust and to dust you will return. I think that's logical to make that assumption from verse 3. Man's smallness is contrasted to God's greatness. Our lives are but a second in time. It passes quickly. It leaves no lasting impact. So, it's very humbling. And that's the point. Again, when we think about worship, and we think about what worship is and what the heart is like that actually engages in genuine, authentic worship, there is an awareness that God is great, that God is glorious, that there is none to compare to Him. But there's also necessary an understanding of the weakness and the frailty and how fragile our lives are, and that we are nothing in His presence. Moses is doing here what Isaiah does in Isaiah 40. He talks about the nations are but a drop in the bucket, they're dust on the scales, all of those things. Again, emphasizing the greatness of God, especially in comparison to the weakness of man. You sweep men away. You wash them away like a flood. He goes on in verses 5 and 6 to talk about grass that with the morning dew or the early morning rains, it pops up and it looks so good, but by evening it's already faded and gone. When the sun comes out, it scorches and withers away. The point is, life passes quickly. Even if you live to be 1,000, that's only a day in God's reckoning. So what is our life but a vapor? And a part of genuine worship is for us to understand just how transient, how fragile, and how passing our lives are. But the point is, you will not get that, you will not understand that until you contrast your life against the greatness and glory of God. That's why both those elements are essential in biblical worship. But the brevity of our life is not our real problem. Our real problem is addressed beginning in verse 7. Because the third truth about, or characteristic about, a worshiping heart is that it reverently bows before the wrath of God. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. You set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They're soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Man's great problem is that he is a sinner. And as a sinner, he is the object or the subject of God's wrath. We talk to people and we ask them, are you saved? Saved from what? From sin? From the devil? No, the great need is to be saved from the wrath of God. The great need is to be delivered from God's judgment. Because the biblical message is all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And the wages of our sin is death. And the bottom line is, biblically, for all of those who are outside of Christ, they are the enemy of God. And if there's anybody you don't want as your enemy, it is the holy, sovereign creator of everything that exists. That's why the psalmist says, we are brought to an end by your anger. We are consumed by your anger is the translation of the New International. Terrified by your indignation. This is a profound set of statements in these verses, verse 7 down through verse 12. Moses gets right to the heart of the problem and traces man's mortality to his sinfulness. Same thing that Paul does in Romans 5. Sin came through one man and life comes through the one man, Jesus Christ. Sin spreads to all because all have fallen sin short. All have sinned and fallen short. So we're consumed. We're terrified by the wrath of God. So verses 10 and 11, talking about our years are 70 or by strength of day, maybe 80, but it's toil and trouble and they're soon gone. That's not a complaint. It's just a statement of reality. Again, he is contrasting his life with the greatness and the grandeur and the glory of God. So what's his conclusion? It's there in verse 12. So, therefore, in light of all this, teach us to number our days so that we might have a heart of wisdom. What is he saying? Teach us to live well. Teach us to live righteously. Teach us to live holy lives. That's what he's talking about. The word wisdom has to do with living well. Wisdom is the skill of living. So he's praying and asking, in light of this, the greatness of God, the glory of God, the frailty of man, the sinfulness of man, Lord, teach us your way. Lord, teach us to live righteously, to number our days aright. That's what true worship is about. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable unto God. That's what Moses in this psalm is asking. Brings us to the fourth and final characteristic. In verse 13 through verse 17. The worshiping heart expectantly pleads for God's gracious relief. Look at it. Return, O Lord. How long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as you have seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. It is an appeal for the outpouring of God's grace, a prayer that he might be satisfied with God himself. It's the heart of worship. I want you. I want relationship with you. I want to live in communion with you. That's all that matters. In prayer that God might work through them and do great things. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us. The worshiping heart understands the mortality of man and the greatness and the glory of God. So he stands in awe of God's glory and grandeur, humbly acknowledging the transient frailty of this life, reverently bows before God's wrath, and expectantly pleads for God's gracious relief. That's what worship is. When we come, we see God for who he is. We see ourselves for what we are. And then we naturally respond with all that we are to all that God is, all that he says, and all that he does.
You've been listening to the TBC Tulsa podcast, which features the preaching ministry of Pastor Rod Harris at Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.